Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself to see if these things be true. All right, we are back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh edition, and we are working our way through the book of Ezekiel. And this week, and towards the end of last week, we're getting to one of the more well-known parts of the entire book. Certainly that's going to be true in the next chapter as well. But I'm going to suggest that when it comes to an understanding from a, if you will, a Torah observant, a messianic, a two-house perspective, where we're at now is some of the very most important, especially where we're going to get to in a few minutes. But in any case, we left off at not quite the end of the first half of chapter 37, having to do with the, well, there's a famous song, too, the dry bones and the prophecy about those. And let me read from verse 11 through the end of the dry bones part, and we'll go to MP and let him pick it up. But this is the place where the prophet is hearing from the creator of the universe, who says, "Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel, Kol Beit Israel. They indeed say, our bones are dry, our hope is lost, and we ourselves are cut off. Therefore, he says, prophesy and say to them, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up from your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. Then you shall know, ki ani Yahuwah, when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up from your graves, I will put my Ruach, my spirit, in you, and you shall live, and I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know," here it is again, "then you shall know that I, Yahuwah, have spoken it and performed it," says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. MP, let's go to you and let you recap where you were and take us through the end of this dry bones prophecy section.
All right. Thank you very much. And good to see. I got an echo. Anyway, verses 11 to 14 have Yah explaining the vision to us that we've just seen through verse 13. Yah told Zeke that the bones represent the whole house of Israel, not only Yehuda. And the whole house of Israel says, our bones are dried. Our hope is lost. Our parts are ligzarnu lanu, cut off from us. I think that the dry bones are the metaphor for their hopes being dashed. The idea seems to be that hope for the resurrection of the just is gone from them, and that it is for that reason that Yah has given this vision to Yechezkel, to rescue Yehuda Yisrael from their metaphorical shipwreck on the shoals of despair. Now, will they heed the call to repentance and to shuv to Yah, turn to him? Azamra has this on verse 12, Yah speaking, "Behold, O my people, I shall open your graves." In the word of Radak, that's one of the great Hebrew sages, okay? If this vision is a metaphor, the lands of the nations where Israel is in Egypt, in exile rather, are the graves. If it is to be taken literally, the meaning is plain. There is a division of opinion among our sages about the dead outside of Israel. Some held that they will rise from their graves in the diaspora itself, while others said that they will come up to the land of Israel by rolling, that is Gilgul, through underground passages. That, you know, how they make this stuff up, I don't know. That's from Kesavos 111a. Now, the present verse supports the view that they will come back to life in the diaspora, for it says, I will open up your graves and bring you up from your graves. And afterwards, I will bring you to the land of Israel. That's Azamra on verse 12. Now, The only question I have is, will we actually see this if we are alive at the time? Okay, can you imagine seeing graves burst open to allow the resurrected flesh to move freely about? How else would Yah get the entire world's attention? Will the National Guard be called out in America ostensibly to protect our people from the marauders from the grave? I can see Sleepy Joe and Cammy shaking in their boots while they make an emergency elimination, both liquid and solid, simultaneously. I wonder how the nightly news will handle that story. Will it be like in all the horror movies of the 50s and 60s, you know, that's how they would report it if they could? Nightmare on Elm Street, Meet Your Match.
They'll just lie about it,
MP. Hire Steven Spielberg to produce and direct it, and some will fall for the fictional media narrative while the truth of Yah stares them in the face, just like they do now. The difference will be that Ruach HaKodesh is who and what will be the source of the story, and some who have heard and stored in the backs of their minds the lessons of Ruach HaKodesh may see the truth and shuv to Yah Tzevaot, and that will be glorious. And that's what I got through verse 14.
All right, Ken, go ahead.
I had already finished up through 14. MP was just catching up. So
exactly.
Yeah, so, could we go ahead and read on at least to verse 20?
Well, let's go. Okay, so we're going to move on then to the next section, which is the two sticks prophecy. And it says in verse 15, yep. Again, the word of Yahuwah came to me saying, as for you, son of man, take a stick for yourself and write on it. Now, I want to point this out as I'm reading through it here. We're clearly talking about two houses, and he's going to make it clear where the lineage of the two whoring wives, the two kingdoms, northern and southern, Ahola and Aholaba, what I refer to sometimes, because I believe he does, as the whore church and the whore synagogue. All of these are clearly, explicitly right here. All right on one of them, for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. And then take another stick and write on that one for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for Kol Beit Israel, all the house of Israel, his companions. So we have essentially the two sticks, one labeled for each, the northern and the southern kingdom, and their respective kings, the kings of the line of Judah in the south, and of Ephraim for the house of Joseph in the north. Then join them to one another for yourself into one stick, a stick that is echad, a unity, and they will become echad, unified, in your hand. And when the Benai, when the children of Israel, your people, speak to you saying, will you not show us what you mean by these? Well, then you say to them, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will join them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand. And let's pause there, and we'll go to Ken this time.
All righty. Well, shalom, everybody out there listening. Hopefully you were here for last week, because, we did cover the first part of this chapter, which was very so important. And keep in mind, again, like I mentioned last week, that you know, last chapter is definitely connected with this chapter directly. So we should keep in mind that this is a end time event. Okay. It's, detailed in last chapter. And then we just have more details in this chapter of pretty much the same event, only from different perspectives.
That's right.
And it actually just simply gives us more detail. So now here, beginning at verse 15, like Mark Collett said, we clearly have text that is speaking of two houses and not just two tribes. And this goes back to the days of Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Recall back in 1 Kings chapter 11 that Yah, through the prophet of Ahiyah, gave 10 tribes to Jeroboam, a mighty man of valor, and left only the tribe of Yehuda, or Judah, with King Shlomo's son, King Rehoboam. Now, if you wonder what happened to the 12th tribe, the Levites, well, they were scattered throughout all the lands of Israel in what was called safe cities. And you'll also read that later, Jeroboam, the northern king, he kicked out all of the Levites from the land of the north. And thus the south became both Yehuda and the Levites. In any case, this division of the tribes to the north and the tribes to the south became what's called the two houses of Israel. And often such houses were named after the largest tribe, which is Yehuda or Judah to the south, and Ephraim, also called Yisrael with regards to houses, to the north. And thus, when it's said, such as in Ezekiel 37, verse 16, that the stick of Yehuda would include the children of Yisrael, his companions, it's speaking of the Levites and any other tribes that may be located in that land, meaning any individuals, you know. Now, likewise, the stick of Ephraim would include the other nine tribes of Israel, comprising of the house of Israel. Again, the house of Israel is often a reference to the northern tribes, okay? It can get a little confused. Sometimes when you read the term house of Israel, it may be the whole house. It just depends on the context. And sometimes house
I will
of
contend,
Israel
Ken,
is the
that's
northern
why it's important. Often, but not always.
Yes, go ahead.
Often, but not always, he will say Kol Israel, or give us an indication of which of the two houses they're talking about. So you're right. As we go through this, it's very important, and it's one of the things that people tend to miss because they're not taught it in Sun God Day School. Which of the houses we're talking about, and whether it's the combined house, the prophetic unified house, or one or the other of the two sets, including the 10 lost tribes, a.k.a. Israel, or what is now or at the time of Yeshua, was Judea or Judah in the south. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, MC. Right on. And also, it is people that we should relate to a stick. This Hebrew word, etz, number 6086, is more often translated as tree or trees than anything else.
That's right.
And whether we read of the word wood, trees, branches, sticks, or vines, we should consider that he may be speaking metaphorically of man. Now, in this case, he most certainly is. And for some proof of such, let me just home in on the translated word branch, which is actually translated from many different Hebrew words, but they all seem to have the same gist. Now, here's just a few that make it fairly clear that he likens a branch to a man. Now, here's, for example, Proverbs 11, verse 28, where it's written, "He that trusteth in his riches shall fall, but the righteous shall flourish as a branch." Let's look at Isaiah 11, verse 1, where it's written, "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots." Even in the Brit Hadashah, New Testament, this is Yochanan or John 15, verses 4 through 6. "Abide in me and I in you." This is Mashiach speaking, by the way. "As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye," or "you, except you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered. And men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned." Hopefully you all, you know, consider this idea of a branch, wood, vine, etc. And you can definitely see how metaphorically this is something that, you know, Yah wants us to put in our minds and keep it in mind when he's speaking, because he often speaks in parables.
That's right.
Especially even in the so-called Old Testament, in the Tanakh. Now, hopefully, so we can all see, it is to make this thematic connection, how important it is, so that we understand how we're truly to be grafted in to a single tree or vine, which our Mashiach, our Messiah, seems to be a root of, as I read there in Yochanan 15. Another important note in these verses is the fact that these two sticks are made one, and they are in his hand. This is a clear indication that these are his people, since they are in his hand. And thus there, it would also be clear indication of a change in these people, because of the fact that the two sticks have become one. In reference to the earlier metaphor within this chapter 37 of the resurrection of the dead, this would provide even more detail as to the fact that once resurrected, they have been changed. Does such an idea maybe ring a bell in our minds? Let's recall a few verses in the Brit Chadashah, or New Testament. I'm going to read a few spots, one of which is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 to 17, where it's written, "But I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, that ye sorrow not, even as others which have no hope. For if we believe that Yahushua died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Yahushua will Elohim bring with him. For this we say unto you by the word of our master, that we are alive and remain unto the coming of our master. It shall not prevent them which are asleep. For the master himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trump of Elohim, and the dead in Mashiach shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the master in the air. And so shall we ever be with the master." I love those words, because it really connects us with a lot of different concepts. Even, for example, the trump. Because if you look at the traditions that the Jews have had for literally thousands of years, and you notice that there was a blowing of trumpets beginning on Yom Teruah, and this lasted actually daily between Yom Teruah and Yom Kippurim, that the very last trump was blown on Yom Kippurim, and it was literally called that. It was called the last trump. And I believe that's what is being spoken of here, because I believe that's when Mashiach comes on Yom Kippurim. Now here's another spot in the Brit Chadashah that we should also consider with regards to this event. This is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 50 through 54, where it's written, "Now this I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of Elohim, neither doth corruption inherit incorruption. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory." Hallelujah. We should see that the resurrection of those in Mashiach will be changed. We will be made on and in him, just as these verses in Ezekiel 37 are stating that there is just one stick in his hand. There will be no more division, it says. There will be no more sin in us. So once changed, we all are one with him in spirit. And that is, we are that one stick. See, that's why I'm trying to emphasize that all of these verses, all of these comments are regarding becoming one in him. I just heard a comment. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question, and this is part of the ways, the place where I'd like to go. We'll have to do a lot of it after the break. But I will contend, and I wonder if it's your contention as well, that this has not, and that's the underscore here, that this has not yet happened. The two houses, the two sticks, northern, southern, Israel, Judah, or if you will, the whore church and the whore synagogue, are not only not restored yet, but are not one in his hand. Are you in agreement there?
Well, like I said, this is a continuation of last chapter when he changes our heart from a heart of stone to a heart of flesh, and he puts his spirit in us so that we can walk in his commandments forevermore, it says. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, it's a future event. I agree.
Okay, because I know certain people, of course, that will claim that, oh, well, it has for me, you know, I don't see that necessarily in a lot of the fruit of the church that still seems to be walking in rebellion to him. How about you, MP? You got about 2 minutes. You want to weigh in, then we'll continue here.
Oh, I'm in complete agreement with you. This is definitely yet future.
Hold on. Can I get one
through the next chapter as well? As yet future.
Couple words in before you take over, MP?
Go for it.
So just to finish this up, thus I'm gathering that his words of being in his hands in these verses is giving us confirmation that we are in him, or echad with him.
Yes.
You know, one with him. I would also correlate being in his hand as doing his works, meaning from that day forth, we will never have to worry about doing other works. We will always desire from our hearts to do his works. That's why he changes our heart and why he puts his spirit in us, so that we can do his works forevermore. So pray that we all may do so one of these days. And go ahead, MP.
Amen. Very good. Yeah, we got about a minute left here, so let me get started, and then I'll take over on the other side of the break. Blue Letter Bible titles the next 9 verses, that's 15 through 23, as Reunion of Yehuda and Israel, or they say Judah and Israel, while your hosts see it as the future resurrection of Ephraim and Yehuda. We may live to witness it before we physically expire, but even if not, we'll be there to experience it. Devariah, Yah Yeshua, told Zeke, take one stick and write for Yehuda and the children of Israel, his companions, and take another stick and write for Yosef, the stick of Ephraim and the house of Israel, his companions. We absolutely and unmistakably see the two houses of Israel here. These are given as if they were camping with the whole of Israel in the wilderness adventure. Yehuda led off when camp was broken, and Yosef brought up the rear. Yehuda, the royal tribe of David, and Yeshua led off with Yosef covering the camp
signal. All right, we're at the break, and we'll pick it up there when we get back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord will turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to stay.
Do-do-do-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come a come a dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come a come a dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Keep the doors ajar too.
Our back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable, talking about what I would suggest, and I think probably the co-host here would agree with me, is one of the most important prophecies, especially when it comes to the things we're seeing now and the things that have been happening that we are simply blind to in a lot of respects because of, well, the whore church and the things that we have not been taught in Sun God Day school. As a matter of fact, the rabbis aren't teaching it either, because there aren't all that many of the synagogues that will talk about two houses. They will talk about the one house. It's all supposed to be under the kings of Judah and their authority, but they do have a problem with some of the well, the distinctions that are being made here. So with that, let's go back to Ken. Let him pick it up, I think, where you were probably, Ken. Go ahead.
Actually, I think MP was still commenting, weren't you, MP?
Oh.
I hadn't even started commenting on 15 to 20 yet.
Well, okay. I remember.
Well, in that case, let me...
Take it whoever wants it, I guess.
Let me slide something in right quick. Is that all right? Okay. I'll go ahead.
Okay. Well, then.
I just wanted to comment on the idea of writing upon the stick. You know, we see that in verse 16. What that brings to mind for me, because of the idea that a stick here represents us. And I believe even our hearts, because remember what last chapter talked about, our stony heart is changed into a fleshly heart. And remember, when you think of the Ten Commandments, which Yah wrote upon stone, right? I believe that is representative when, in terms of putting it in the ark, it is representative of our hearts. And how, as long as these words are on stone, it kind of shows how we are very stiff-necked. You know, we're very hardened in the heart.
Yes.
And you can remember, even when Yah was conveying himself to all of Mitzrayim, or Egypt, what did he have to do? He said he had to harden the Pharaoh's heart. This is kind of figurative, remember, metaphoric, of making it to where things your own way. The problem with agreeing with Yah's perfection and walking in his ways, which is would be considered a fleshly heart. And I believe that's why you saw in between Yah himself, who sat on that so-called mercy seat, right? It was a throne. It was
Absolutely.
Representative of a throne. So between him, which was above the mercy seat, and below, which was representative of us and our hardened hearts, was this so-called mercy seat, or lid of atonement. So it had to do with the need for atonement. Not to mention, you had the cherubim, or cherubims, that were, I shouldn't say cherubims, just cherubim, which is plural. You had those on top, just like what happened with the Garden of Eden. Remember, Yah put cherubim between man and the garden from then on to separate. You know, there had to be a separation between the perfect and the, let's just say, fallen. You know, and that's how we've been. But until we are perfected, now I believe when we're perfected is when he writes his commandments upon our fleshly hearts, which means it will not leave our hearts. It will exude from within. You know, we will from then on always do Yah's works, as long as his commandments are written upon our fleshly hearts. And he even says that he will write them upon our hearts. So I think that it's a good metaphor going on here with the idea of writing upon the stick, okay, which is, I believe, representative of, you know, writing his commandments upon us so that we can walk perfectly from then on. So that was the additional comment. Let me go ahead and turn it over.
All right. Let me cover 15 to 20, and we'll lay it out. Anyway, here it goes. Blue Letter Bible titles the next 9 verses, that is 15 through 23, as Reunion of Judah and Israel, while our hosts see it as the future redemption of Ephraim and Yehuda. We may live to witness it before we physically expire, but even if not, we'll be there to experience it. Now, Devar Yah, Yah Yeshua, told Zeke, take one stick and write for Yehuda and the children of Israel, his companions, and take another stick and write for Yosef, the stick of Ephraim, and the house of Israel, his companions. We absolutely and unmistakably see the two houses of Israel here. These are given as if they were camping with the whole of Israel in the wilderness adventure. Yehuda led off when the camp was broken. Yosef brought up the rear. Yehuda, the royal tribe of David, and Yeshua led off, with Yosef covering the camp 6. The royalty of Israel led off, and the righteousness of Israel kept their eyes on what might follow. It all connects. In verses 18 through 20, Yah told Zeke that the people would ask him what all of the stuff means, and Yah gives him an overview answer and would answer every question raised by Zeke exactly as he would have addressed it, except by Zeke's voice. Yah tells him to take the 2 sticks that he carried and put them together. Now, I wasn't there, so I can only surmise what the scene was like. The 2 houses are each represented by a stick, but I think that they are fashioned in such a way as to fit like a hand in a glove. The 2 sticks in the Tzadik Melech's hand would look as if they were only one somewhat larger stick. When the 2 were properly put together in one hand, in other words, they looked like a single stick.
Can I pause?
That is pretty much the relationship. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, can I pause you just a second? I'm going to go a step further, because when I picture this, honestly, I actually think that whether it happened physically or the prophet saw it, that he put those 2 sticks in his hand and they regrew themselves together. In other words, they weren't just happened to be formed in the right way already. They're still not fitting together very well. They regrew and they joined themselves together and they physically became one stick, and the roots and the branches and everything joined right there in his hand. So I see that as a bit more miraculous and a lot more like what we're hopefully looking forward to. But go ahead.
It's a very good possibility. However, that will happen in Messiah's hand and didn't happen in any human being's hand. If they took the 2 sticks and put them together, I think that that's neither here nor there. Okay, so the 2 houses are each represented by a stick, but I think that they were fashioned in such a way as to fit like a glove. When the 2 were properly put together in one hand, in other words, they looked like a single stick. And as you said, they may have just formed together miraculously, by the will of Yah. Anyway, and it's pretty much the relationship of Yehuda and Yosef. You can see how this all came to pass in Genesis 45. You can also see the reunion of Yehuda and Yosef in Yehoshua's circumcision, when Miriam's husband, Yosef, named her son Yehoshua at his circumcision, because the rightful heir to the throne of Yehuda, Yosef, Miriam's husband, named our Mashiach Yehoshua, thereby making him his principal heir. Yehoshua was literally the rightful king of Yehuda and Israel. This is seen, if you wish, in the two different genealogies in Matthew chapter 1 and 3, which are the genealogies of Miriam in Luke and of Joseph in Matthew. The only places the two genealogies match is at Zerubbabel, Shealtiel, and at David. Miriam and Joseph were both descended from Shealtiel and Zerubbabel and David, but all the other names are different. Both Joseph and Miriam were of David and of Shealtiel and Zerubbabel, so Joseph and Miriam could have been distant cousins, but both gave Yeshua his Davidic title. And Joseph was the rightful king of Israel in that generation. So when Joseph named Yeshua at his circumcision, he was claiming him as his rightful heir, even though he was not Joseph's offspring. Now, in verses 21 to 23, Adonijah tells Zeke that he will eventually take all the children of Israel who are scattered to the winds and gather them to himself in their own land that they receive from him. When he does this, and we saw this beginning 75 years ago in the return of the nation of Israel to the promised land, the completion of this promise is yet future, since Israel has yet to take full possession of her lands, but not to worry. Yah promised that he shall fulfill it in the not-too-distant future. That will be a glorious day. The ultimate fulfillment will be when Yah Yeshua sits his throne in Yerushalayim, as we see in Revelation 21 and 22, with partial descriptions in many of the Old Testament prophets and in the apostolic writings. I'm going to stop at the end of verse 21 here and pass it on to you guys.
Ahead, Ken.
I've gone through verse 21.
Yeah, well, I think we need to read on a little bit from 21 on.
Okay.
There you go,
MC.
So I'm going to join the two sticks together, and the sticks on which you write will become echad, or a unity in your hand. So then he says, verse 20, say to them, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, surely I will take the B'nai Israel from among the Goyim, the nations, wherever they've gone, and will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land. Now, this, again, of course, is right out of the book of Deuteronomy and what it is that Moshe tells us as well. So that's not a new prophecy. That's a repetition of a promise already made. And I will make them echad, one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king over them all. They shall no longer be two nations, nor shall they ever be again divided into two kingdoms. And let's pause there because there's more, and this is going to make it even more clear that this hasn't happened yet. Let's go to you first this time, MP, and then we'll go back to Ken.
Okay, I'm starting at verse 22, and I'll take us right to the end of the chapter. Where did you stop reading?
At the place where they won't defile themselves anymore. I didn't read that verse 23.
Okay, so verse 22 is Yah's promise to Israel that they shall be one kingdom on their land of promise, and that one king shall rule them all. I wonder if his name is Aragorn, you know. It couldn't be.
I wonder where he got that.
Lord of the Rings. Anyway, his name is Yehoshua. This kingdom will be one over Ephraim and Yehuda, and the king will be Mashiach Yeshua. And since Yeshua is Yah in risen human flesh, he will reign, to quote our old friend Rob Miller, I'm going to do it just like he did, forever. And I think because Yah himself in the flesh of Yehoshua is sitting his throne over the whole universe, which I think will also be universally inhabitable, there will be no end to the growth and reach of Mashiach Yeshua's kingdom from Yerushalayim. I see no reason why the kingdom can't include every star and planet over time, with Yehoshua's faithful perfectly representing him in the inhabitants of those worlds. He promises in verse 23 that our sin natures, will be expunged at least, and quite possibly memories of ever having been a sinner wiped out as well. Moshe Konyakowski's Restoration Scriptures has this quote for verse 23. Clearly, both houses remain defiled. Both houses have sinned, and both houses have not been cleansed. The reunion could not have been a past event. For had it been so, then no sin, disgusting practice, or idolatry would now be found in either house. And that is correct. And I thank Moshe Konyakowski for that insight. That is just a wonderful insight. It could not possibly have happened yet.
Well, he's going to make that clear
now,
in the next verse, too.
23, I'm going to quit there. I got a very short comment on 24 to 28.
All right, Ken, what you want to add?
And two, could we read at least to verse 25? Because my comments are kind of like from 21 to 25.
Okay, well, since we're going to go there, and this is, again, going
to
make the point.
To the end
this can't have happened yet.
Yeah. Okay.
They shall not defile themselves anymore, says verse 23, with their idols, nor with their detestable things, their bunnies and their eggs and their Christmas trees, nor with any of their transgressions. Trans anything. But I will deliver them from all their dwelling places to which they have, in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. Then they shall be my people, and I will be their Elohim, and David, my servant, shall be king over them. And they shall all have one shepherd. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. What? You mean they'll actually be Torah obedient? They'll read what it was Yeshua said about not changing any of it?
Yeah.
Presumably that's what he's referring to here. Then they shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob, my servant, where your fathers dwelt. And they shall dwell there, and their children and their children's children forever. And my servant David shall be their prince forever. And let's pause before we get to the last part, because that, too, is really important. All right. Go ahead, if you're ready, Ken.
Sure. So, again, like I said earlier, at this time in this chapter, I think it's important that we remember that we are still reading a continuation. The previous chapter, considering his word written in scrolls never did have chapters and verses. This entire chapter is just more detail to the idea going on in the previous chapter, which spoke of a time to come in the future where he changes us by giving us a heart of flesh and putting his spirit within us, and thus ensuring that we would walk in his ways forevermore. Hopefully you notice that, especially in verse 23, where he was saying that never again will you defile yourselves, meaning you will never again sin. Okay? That's what it's saying. Yeah, so we know this must be a future event. This cannot be anything that's happened in the past. And the last chapter also spoke of these words being gathered from throughout the world and being brought to the land that we were to inherit, one that would be ruled by a king of his choosing to be governed as one people under one authority, which is, of course, his authority or name. And this change in us would ensure that we would no longer walk in sin and do as we had been doing for thousands of years, which was really turning away from him. He seems to be reiterating some important details from last chapter that are apparently important to him and thus should be important to us. And there is truly hope in the thought of us being his people and him being our Elohim forevermore. I mean, that's one wonderful thought. And I personally am excited about having Dawid as our king again.
Amen.
I very much look forward to meeting him in person. But this, you know, all of this gives me so much, you know, so much hope, more so than pretty much anything else in scripture, knowing that, that in the end, you know, we're all going to be together again and we're all going to be set apart. We'll be changed, you know, we'll have this heart that, that he writes his commandments within and we are able to walk in them perfectly forever. I mean, forever and ever. And let me stop there because the last few verses have a very, important, theme going on there as well. So let me, that's what I have up to verse 25.
Okay.
All right. Have we read through the end of the chapter yet, Mark?
I've been waiting on you, MP. Are you ready to continue or should I go on?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, so let's finish the chapter up. It says, we got just time before the break. This will probably take us to the break. Moreover, he says, I will make a covenant of peace. And we've seen that one before in the Torah, haven't we? A covenant of peace with them, and it shall be an everlasting covenant with them. Remember the fellow that ran Zimri and Cozbi through with the great big spear? Pinchas or Phinehas. He had a covenant of peace. It was everlasting too. I will establish them and multiply them, and I'll set my sanctuary in their midst forevermore. And my tabernacle also shall be with them. Indeed, I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. The Goyim, the nations, will also know that I, Yahuwah, sanctify Israel, and my sanctuary is in their midst forevermore. And let's see. We got about a minute. Ken, let's go to you if you want to try to take us out in the time we've got.
I'm going to try that here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Please notice that David will be king over Chol Yisrael, and he will be their shepherd while they will observe and walk in Yah's judgments and statutes to perform them. And I think that will be more perfectly and in order, done perfectly and in order. Remember, new heavens, new earth. This will definitely be the new creation in which only righteousness will dwell. The promises of verse 25 and following are obviously set in a new creation in which there will be no sin or death. There will be universal worship of Yah and obedience to his son all through the human leadership of Melech David as he is empowered by his heir, Mashiach Yeshua, forever. That's what's going to happen. And that's all I got for this chapter.
Okay, take us out, Ken. Less than a minute.
Less than a minute. Boy, you guys are just cruel. I mean, I'll be able to get just a few words out. May as well sing a song or something here till the music comes along, a different tune.
All my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for.
Okay,
for the
people. I should have never let you guys even try it. I'll just go ahead and do it.
Thanks, MP.
At least we won't have to have singing. So what we'll do when we get back is we'll let you finish when you think you've got more time and you're not quite so tongue-tied. And then after that, we'll talk about another thing which doesn't seem to have been yet fulfilled, and that has to do with Ezekiel 38:9.
I'm the God I'm breathing, and I pray don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true.
I know someday it'll all turn around because people to say that we don't want to fight no more.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition. We're talking about the end of chapter 37 and one of the most, I think, significant prophecies in the book of the prophet Ezekiel. And it has to do with the two sticks, the two houses, the two warring wives, the two kingdoms that become one in his hand. And I think we're all at least here in agreement that that hadn't happened yet. I want to introduce this this segment with one more element from Scripture that we've seen. This one kind of sticks out in my mind when I think about whether it's happened or not. This is Acts chapter 1, and this is following the resurrection. And essentially it says right up front that he has showed himself alive after his passion by many infallible proofs, having seen them 40 days, speaking of things pertaining to the kingdom of Elohim. They being assembled together commanded them they shouldn't depart from Jerusalem, but wait for the promise of the Father, which he said, you've heard of me, for Yohanan and John baptized with water, but you will be baptized with the Ruach HaKodesh not many days hence. Now, the point of the book of Acts, at least one of them, is that that in fact did happen here, but I'm going to suggest that the next couple of verses indicate there's still parts that we're waiting on. Therefore, when they'd come together, they asked him, saying, listen to this, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Now, this was one of the things that they kept waiting for all along. Still hadn't happened yet. And the response, he said to them, it's not for you to know the times and the seasons, or the seasons, which the Father has put in his own power. But you shall receive power after the Ruach HaKodesh has come upon you. You shall be witnesses unto me, both in Jerusalem and in all Judea, and in Samaria, and in the uttermost, or to the uttermost parts of the earth. So, Judea would be the southern kingdom where they're at, and in Samaria, at least part of what would have once been the northern kingdom, lost Israel, the 10 lost tribes, but remember, they've been scattered even beyond that at this point, and, he says, under the uttermost parts of the earth. So, I'll ask, let's see, which of you guys, where do you want to go first? I don't see a comment on the screen. Well, let's go to Ken. Let him comment on it first.
I'm a little lost because the echo, with the bad echo that I had on my end, I couldn't tell where you were reading from.
I did recognize one, some of the verse 6, where he says,
Acts chapter 1.
Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?
Okay, which we know that when Messiah stood up at one point in his ministry and began reading what I think was from the book of Isaiah, he read up to a point where it talked about healing the sick and such, which he was doing. It also ended, those verses ended with some idea of a conquering king, which he did not read the rest of those verses. So even though I know the Jews believe that there is two messiahs and one coming, I believe a lot of us, at least from either Christianity or the Hebrew Roots movement, and other, denominations, believe in one Messiah, two visitations, or two comings. We saw in his first coming that he came as as Mashiach ben Yosef. Now this is actually something that the Jews actually do say, that there is a Mashiach ben Yosef and a Mashiach ben David, which really gives a picture of two messiahs, which is how they look at it. One who is a servant, the Mashiach ben Yosef, and the other being son of David, Mashiach ben David, which is a conquering king. Now, we in Christianity, Hebrew Roots, and other, possibly Messianic Judaism, etc., we believe that Messiah came first to be the Mashiach ben Yosef, and actually helped us to learn how to walk and turn from our sin. You know, he was a physical example. But we also believe that he will come again as the conquering king. So this is something that the Jews most definitely had a real problem with in terms of accepting the Messiah of that day because of the fact that he didn't fulfill those future prophecies, which would be of, you know, coming as a conquering king. And this is why we have a little bit of a difference between Judaism and Christianity, mostly, you know, is that, you know, the Jews didn't, or at least the Jews of today, most of them, especially those that are the Orthodox type, even the Karaite Jews, don't believe that Mashiach was here, whereas we do. So I think that's the big, you know, difference in those words that we're reading from the beginning of the book of Acts. That would be my comment on that.
Okay. Well, the only thing I would add to that is that, you know, having spoken to a lot of Jews and people that have been that way and that have come back to a more messianic perspective, I would add that the Jesus that they've heard about who did away with the law obviously could not be the Mashiach. So they would say that's another reason for knowing that he hadn't even come once, because if he'd done away with the Torah, he would have been a liar and the truth is not in him. So for all of those reasons, I think what we're still seeing here is that those two sticks have not yet become one. All right. Go ahead, MP. Why don't you take it to where you'd like? Comment on that if you would.
All right. Well, I'm gonna go ahead and comment. You've read through what in chapter 38 of Ezekiel?
38? No. I'm not even finished with 37 yet.
Oh, well, in that case, I'm ready to move on to 38. So why don't you go ahead and finish 37, Ken?
Well, I think MC was asking if you might have any comment as to those few beginning verses in Acts chapter 1. MP, did you have
In Acts chapter 1. I'm sorry. Yeah. I wasn't listening to that. I can't do that right now. I don't have any idea what they even say.
Well, I think we're probably all in agreement on the most part in that.
I'll pretty much guarantee that.
Yeah. It is somewhat representative of the two houses, even though those houses have changed through the years. But I think representatively, we may consider those of us that believe Messiah came already, that we may fall into that house of Israel or house of Ephraim, of that camp or that house, whereas the house of Yehuda or Judah would be representative of, for example, remember Messiah's parable of the two brothers? One that stayed in the house, who was kind of jealous of the one who had left the house, because the one who had left the house was actually in sin because he was leaving the house. But the father continued to, you know, desire for him to come back home. He still loved his son, even though his son left him, you know, turned his face from him. And that's kind of where we've been for a long time. We have turned our face from him. In the meantime, Yehuda or Judah or the Jews are still in the land, and they're still maintaining that they keep Torah, etc. So they're, you know, metaphorically in the house still. Okay, and that I think is a good representation of today, is those two brothers that the Messiah came up with a parable. Do you think that's a kind of a good tie in there, Mark Hall?
Yeah,
that's
what
fine. Talking about? Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I would agree. We can probably say that and it's kind of morphed somewhat into how we are today. You know, those that believe Mashiach has been here on the most part would be those from the northern, you know, northern 10 tribes that were kicked out of the house first. Remember, kicked out of the land. And Yehuda or Judah did later. In the meantime, how about if I go ahead and comment on the last three verses of chapter 37? Would that be okay at this time?
Sure, go
please.
Ahead.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. Well, firstly, one thing I'd like to comment on is verse 26. It starts off saying, I will make a covenant of peace. And, you know, that word make is not the word make we would normally see. Usually the word make or made would be the Hebrew word asah. Okay, this is not the word asah. This is, let's see, the Hebrew word karath. Okay, Strong's number H3772, which I'm counting here in the Strong's. It counts 175 translated times as the word cut.
Yeah, it's cut a covenant. It's where it's
and funny thing
used.
Is about 80. Yeah, exactly. Cut a covenant. And about 80 times it translates it as the word made or make. But the funny thing is when you look at every single instance of made or make, it's in conjunction with the word covenant. So it kind of makes sense that it really does have to do with a cutting, kind of like what happened to Abraham, if we recall, when he cut the pieces and he walked through. It's kind of representative also of circumcision, the cutting of the flesh. It's kind of the same idea there. Also, you'll note when sometimes you'll see, for example, someone dies, and let's say they die in sin, it will say that they were cut off from their people. That word cut off would be this word as well. This word, karath, okay? Cut off, which if you think about it, if you're cut off from Yah's people, you are now cut from the covenant. You're literally cut off from the covenant. So I think it's all related. You know, the covenant itself is most assuredly related to an idea of the cutting of the pieces, so to speak. The cutting of the flesh. And I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, that does make a difference in what or how we're considering these words at the beginning of verse 26. I think this covenant is a very integral act between us and him. Okay. It's not just something that's made, so to speak. It's really something that Yah, you know, slices together, you know. He brings us and him together in covenant. That's kind of what covenant is. Now, not only will we dwell with him in a place that our fathers have dwelt before, it says, but there will be an everlasting covenant of peace with all, it says, with all that had been taken away in the past due to sin. Let me read just a few verses to kind of look at the idea of a covenant of peace. This is a few instances of this idea of covenant of peace that's in our scriptures. First, Mark Hall had mentioned this a little bit earlier in Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 25 verse 12. It's written, wherefore say, behold, I give unto him a covenant of peace. This is to Pinchas, who is a Levite.
That's right.
Okay. And here in Isaiah 54 verse 10, for the mountains shall depart and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith Yahuwah, that hath mercy on thee. Okay, this is in speaking about his people. Remember, here he said, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed. So it will return to us. Malachi 2 verse 5. My covenant was with him of life and peace. And I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name, which again, I think that has to do with authority. He was respectful of Yah's authority. Now this is regarding the Levites. Okay. The covenant of peace should be considered one of the true blessings that Yah can bestow upon us, where there is no longer any conflict. There's no worry. There's no doubt. When we are one with him amongst us, all will be joyful and peaceful, like we could never have imagined. I don't even think we can quite understand such a covenant of peace, because this world and our lives have been so full of sin and wickedness and division, and you know, we could go on and on and on. Moreover, Dawid, his servant, David, King David, will be with us as our prince. And we know that if Yah dwells amongst us, we are at that point truly his people. And as he concludes, this will be forevermore. Hallelujah. And notice he mentioned both in verses 27 and 28. He talks about the tabernacle and the sanctuary. Okay. The tabernacle is the word Mishkan. Sanctuary is the word Mikdash. Okay. They, yep. Of course, we read these words a lot in the Torah, the first books. And Yisrael was brought out of Mitzrayim, or out of bondage, and they came to be with Yah. You see this a lot when he draws near unto his people and they draw near unto him. There is a tabernacle, and that tabernacle is a sanctuary. Okay. And remember that there will be, and in terms of the end of days, it's been prophesied that there will be a newly built tabernacle, but one not with the hands of man. I believe this has to do with a spiritual tabernacle where Mashiach, our Messiah, is the cornerstone. And we are all of the remaining stones. Because remember, just like trees, you know, metaphorically speaking, stones are often also representative of man or his people. Because a stone, unlike a brick, for example, is something that is naturally molded, meaning Yah molds it, okay? Whereas a brick, there is a man-made tool, you know, that conforms it, you know? And that's how a lot of people are. They end up being created or conformed or edited or molded with man's ways, you know, man's directions, man's commandments, etc. But if we stand clear of that, we're truly a stone, you know, we're truly molded. We let ourselves be molded by Yah. Then we're truly a stone, and we are one with Mashiach in this spiritual tabernacle to come. And I believe that's why we kind of read about this in the book of Revelation, where there's all this light, you know, when Yerushalayim from the heavens comes down, there's all this light, but I don't believe there is a so-called building or a tabernacle. I think we're just one with that tabernacle. We're a part of it, you know, and that's the metaphoric idea, the thematic connection in a way of, in terms of us being one in Messiah, and that making us being with our Father. You know, because remember, when Mashiach left, he said, I am going to build a place for you, You know, remember that? I mean, he was literally becoming that cornerstone, and he would be our high priest from that day forward, you know, to help us so that we can become a part of such a tabernacle, a place that Mashiach will be helping to build for us. So anyway, that's what I have through the end of the chapter.
Okay.
We ready now, MP?
Yeah, ready to move on through for chapter 38, 1 through 6, and we're probably going to get cut off pretty soon.
Well, we can read those verses before we get to the bottom of the hour. Anyway, then it says, now the word of Yahuwah came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, and Rosh, of course, means head, Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and lead you out with all your army, horses and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Let's read one more verse, and that'll take us to the break. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all its troops, the house of Togarmah from the far north, and all its troops, many people are with you. So prepare yourself and be ready, you and all your companies that are gathered about you, and be a guard for them, because after many days you'll be visited. In the latter years you will come into the land of those brought back from the sword and gathered from many people on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of the nations, and now all of them dwell safely. Now, let's pause here because we're at the bottom of the hour break, and note that this looks like something that may or may not have happened, and that's a great place to pick it up when we get back. But there are elements here that have been completed and elements that haven't. So they've been brought out of nations.
Absolutely.
There's many nations. Now all of them dwell safely. You will ascend among coming like a storm, covering the land like a cloud, you and all your troops and many peoples with you. And 30 seconds more, I think. Thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, on that day it'll come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind and you'll make an evil plan. Wow, which evil plan? And you'll say, I will go up against a land of unwalled villages. I'll go to a peaceful people. Who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take plunder and to take booty, to stretch out your hand against the waste places that are again inhabited, and against the people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods, who dwell in the midst of the land. And let's pause there. Let's see. Looks like, I guess, that this particular break, we've got one more minute to go. MP, you want to comment on any of that? I went further than you wanted before we get back.
I'll get in a sentence or two here. Devariah in chapter 38 seems to like dealing with Yehezkel, and it's likely because when Yah asks him to do something, he not only says okay, but he seems to ask, and in exactly what manner would you like me to do that? Should I, my expression be stern, or should it be with a smile?
How high?
You remember that Zeke's Abba was Yirmiyahu.
He says jump.
Sometimes I love, I'm there.
All right, what's the break, though?
I'm there, God, I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turns around, because
Let's say that
back, folks. Last segment now of the Torah Teachers Roundtable for today. We finished chapter 36, and we are headed into chapter 37, and the actually chapter 38, and the section that's known as the Ezekiel 38-39 War. So we're going to see this actually take the next couple of chapters. But I read the first few verses, and we've outlined some of the places and some of the peoples, but primarily places that are identified with peoples and the setup for the war. Let me go to MP and let him comment on it at this point.
All right. Yeah, how far did you read?
I read through about 20-something, 22 or the, no, 12.
Oh, 38-12. Okay, well, I can cover that. Devariah seems to like dealing with Yechezkel, and it's likely because when Yah asks him to do something, he not only says, okay, but he seems to ask, and in exactly what manner do you want me to do that? Should my expression be stern, or should it be with a smile? You remember that Zeke's Abba was Yirmiyahu, the prophet who wept almost every time Yah gave him an oracle to deliver. Verse 38, or chapter 38 rather, discusses Gog u'Magog. I'll take this chapter by the KJV paragraph, and my comments on verses 1 to 6 are going to follow. But I'm going to read the KJV paragraph here first. And the word of Yah came to me saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And say, Thus saith Adonai Yah, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks in thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thy army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma of the north quarters, and all his bands, many people with thee. Okay. Now, Stone Sanak has a good opening comment on verse 1. They say chapters 38 and 39 foretell the climactic war of Gog u'Magog, which will introduce the end of days and the Messianic era. In it, Gog, from the land of Magog, allied with a multitude of nations, will attack or advance to attack Israel in its, that is, Israel's own land. The war will end with the destruction of Israel's enemies and the promised Messianic era of bliss. Rambam, that is Rabbi Moshe ben Machmanides, cautions against attempting to pinpoint the time and identity of the kingdoms discussed in this prophecy, which is wise, it is very sage advice. I call that sage advice, what with it coming from the Hebrew sages and all. Here's KJV on verses 1 through 6. Here's KJV's verses 1 through 6. Devariah came to me saying, this has already been read, hasn't it? I'll jump beyond it. Togarma of the north quarters, that could be anywhere north of Israel. But if you were to draw a straight line to the North Pole from Jerusalem, what nations or landmarks might you cross? Turkey, the Black Sea, Crimea, Moscow, Ukraine, you betcha. That stuff has been in the forefront of the news for the past 2 to 2.5 years. Is quite possibly the lead-in to a present-day Gog-U-Magog battle, and possibly the Gog-U-Magog battle. There are truly cities called Tobolsk, Tubal, and Moskva, Meshek, Moscow maybe? Not but a few, 3 or 4 degrees, east or west of a straight line between the Temple Mount and the North Pole. Seriously, I drew the map. I drew it on the map. It's amazing how much a line going just to the North Pole from the Temple Mount crosses that we are listening to on the news every day for the last 2.5 years. Anyway, it may be possible that our bad guys in Yechezkel, might be the same nations that Biden is working to economically and physically destroy in that neighborhood as we speak. Russia is not a country that we want to anger, a thing that Sleepy Joe seems to want to do. As Meshach and Tubal, we're not for Yerushalayim. Wikipedia, it's got to be true, has Gomer on the Crimean Peninsula and on the nearby Russian-Ukrainian mainland. I think Yah may be allowing this in anticipation of his judgment, which can be seen in the majority of the book of Revelation. I think that we are on the verge of a whole lot of end-time prophecy fulfillment. Here's a link. I sent the link to you, MC, and I'm not going to be able to show it to the people online, but you might be able to put that into the text for the show here. Anyway, I'm not asking you to do that. MC may be able to include it in HNR's notes. So anyway, it's wikipedia.org/wiki/Togarma #.
Well, just do
media.
A search for Togarma and Wikipedia, you'll come up with it. But we'll try to put it in
okay.
The links.
Exactly. Okay. So anyway, that's what I got through verse 6. If you'd like to read on, we can do a little bit more.
Ken, do you want to add anything?
Ken is shy some notes, but you may have gotten something that came to mind, Ken, if you'd like to jump in.
You know, it's funny. We could also consider that these are groups that have, you know, changed through the years, just like the tribes. Okay, changed through the years. The people who are a part of the tribes. We have different people who are in the so-called land of Magog, Tubal, Meshach, of course, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya, Gomer. I mean, we got all these places and probably houses and tribes mentioned here, you know. A lot of them could lead to, let's say, peoples of today that are not, you know, people who are part of those who follow the words of Yah. They could be those who follow other religions of today. I mean, there are so many religions today, especially if you go out to places like Persia, Ethiopia, Libya.
Amen.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you may not find a whole lot of folks that are of the, let's say, Christian background. They might be other denominations religions. So to speak. So it could be that a lot of these are people who are becoming like-minded against those who are the people of Yah. Yeah. And in a way, I wonder, because a lot of people today are being bought out, the way I see it. A lot of leaders of many, many countries are following suit with the globalists who are trying to take control.
Yep.
And, you know, we could be speaking about a lot of these areas in the world and how they are all, you know, little by little, they're being overrun and taken control of and now are going to begin persecuting his people, literally. They're going to start persecuting Christianity or anything else that's going to band together against those who desire to take control of everything, you know? And this really could be a picture of the end of days. And this is saying, I mean, it is pointing to the latter years, it says in verse 8. It says, after many days, thou shalt be visited in the latter years that come into the land. And it just makes me wonder if this isn't kind of metaphoric and even a continuation again of what we've been reading in the last couple of chapters of that time, those end of days, And this is something that we also have to go through before we are changed. You know, this could be that moment, just before. So it could even be what we're going through right now with this wicked, let's call it deep state. At least in this country, it's definitely a part of the deep state, I believe.
Absolutely.
I think that even if we're able to put away the people like Biden and Kamala Harris, I still think the deep state is still there. They may still continue marching forward, you know, with bringing us down and putting away our freedoms and, you know, all kinds of terrible things. So could this be a picture of the days we're in? That's what I'm wondering. This could be, you know, metaphoric for what we're going through right now.
The answer is yes, Ken.
Yeah.
I see.
That's scary.
All through this chapter.
Yeah, that's scary. Anyway, that's all I was connecting to with these verses up to about 6 or 7.
Okay. Are we ready to read on
then? You want
to
go ahead?
Read on at least through 9.
One more that I think is worth pointing out. This does, again, it's listed in the section MP wants to put in the messages in the podcast links from Wikipedia. But Togarma is listed in Genesis chapter 10 as the third son of Gomer, which is also noted in this section here, then the grandson of Japheth. He's the brother of Ashkenaz, yep. And we know that as the root name for the Ashkenazi people, one of the major sects, if you will, or lineages of Judaism, and Riphtha. So a lot of elements here are coming together. But let me pick it up in chapter 38 at about verse 12, where it says, which referencing a land of unwalled villages. Now, I got to admit, even though we're talking about areas that are pretty clearly identified with places in the Middle East and Turkey and in elements of Assyria and to the north, and as MP was pointing out, all the way up into what is, or at least were parts of the Soviet Empire and modern-day Russia and so forth, much of the world today is unwalled villages, and certainly if there's a place where many of us would say, hey, here's a land of unwalled villages, you might be thinking that's the United States too. And obviously when there are references to all kinds of people being scattered and gathered together in places, you can't help but think that too is part of it. And ultimately I suggest that when we're talking about a world war, it's hard not to find elements that are going to be included in this. So, thus says Yahuwah Elohim, on that day it'll come to pass that thoughts will arise in your mind. You'll make an evil plan. Well, that sounds like so many places in the world. Unwalled villages, I'll go to a place where there's a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them without walls, neither bars nor gates, to take plunder, to take booty, to stretch out your hand against the waste places that are again inhabited, and against the people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods who dwell in the midst of the land. Sheba, Dedan, and merchants of Tarshish, and all their young lions will say to you, have you come to take plunder? Have you gathered your army to take booty, to carry away silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, to take great plunder? That does sound a lot like what we've seen out of the swamp too, doesn't it? And as a matter of fact, much of history, if you think about it. Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, on that day when my people Israel dwell safely, will you not know it? Then you will come from your place out of the far north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great company and a mighty army. You'll come up against my people Israel like a cloud, cover the land. It'll be in the latter days that will I bring against you my land, so that... that I will bring you against my land, so that the nations may know me, the Goyim, the nations, may know me, when I am hallowed in you, O Gog, before their eyes. And thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, as are you he of whom I have spoken in former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel, who prophesied for years in those days that I would bring you against them. So here we go. It ends with a question. That's a great place to stop. And let's go back to MP, let him comment on where we're at.
Okay, very good. I'm listening to myself. Okay, let's see. Verses 7 through 9. Yah's word to Gog Umagog is a Boy Scout motto, be prepared. And he must mean it since he says it twice in one breath. Verse 8 says, after many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. After many days in the latter years. If the stuff going on with Russia and Ukraine and their respective allies is the beginning of a fulfillment of this prophecy, and it very well may be, it's going to get a whole lot worse before it gets better. It won't be just the regional powers, Russia, Ukraine, the eastern parts, or even the entire lot of NATO powers, but the Chinese and its minions in the East Asia as well, who will be sending troops and materiel to the fight. We're talking World War III, and it will likely go nuke. I fully expect a bunch of nukes being sent to strategic places all along both U.S. coasts and the whole and the major military base areas like Cheyenne Mountain and Colorado Springs, mainly to take out the Stargate. And that's a joke. There is no Stargate. However, that's where NORAD is at. Okay. And you drop a couple of hundred nukes on there, and I don't care how big the mountain is, you ain't gonna have any more NORAD. Okay. And that's all they gotta do is aim a bunch of nukes at it, and it's gone. Now, I don't like Cheyenne Mountain. I don't think Cheyenne Mountain will survive the hundreds of nukes sent for it from both Russia and China. Now, what do you think China's surveillance balloons were doing over, as they passed over in February? Mark Call lives about 75 to 100 miles from there, from NORAD, okay?
No, further than that, thankfully.
And I have a – what was that?
It's further You're than closer that, than thankfully.
That? Yeah. Yeah, and I have a son and daughter-in-law and 5 grandkids that live 5 miles from there. Okay? I got money in this one. Those people got to come out of there. Anyway, 5 grandchildren within 5 or 6 miles of Cheyenne Mountain. And that doesn't count on my eldest brother and my only sister who live on the north slope of Pikes Peak. I'm going to lose most of my family if this actually happens. Okay. And that doesn't, if Cheyenne Mountain gets nuked, my entire Colorado family is very likely toast. MC may survive such a thing as the prevailing winds and weather is west to east, but that isn't certain either. I think we are studying our very near future in this passage of Yechezkel right now. Notice the timing in verse 8, after many days. I think that today qualifies for that in Yechezkel's mind. The way I read verse 8, there will not be a lot of destruction done to Israel in this battle. What with the prevailing westerlies, the worst will be north and west of the land, in my not so humble opinion. In fact, it could be that Yah will work for Israel and clean up the area after a few months or years of the battle briefly described in verses 4 through 7. If this prophecy is scheduled for the near future and we are witnessing the beginnings of it coming to pass in our nightly news, Ethiopia probably speaks of Black Africa and Libya probably speaks of Arab Africa coming to Russia's aid, whether as mercenaries or as allies. Remember that Putin and Xi have gotten very chummy recently, and that all over the Ukraine. Now, Russia has taken some heavy casualties with the Ukrainian military using American and European weapons against Russian cities in the Donetsk region. In verse 9, under my proposed scenario, Russia is going to eat Ukraine's lunch, and Israel will acknowledge in this war. And again, this all assumes the soon-to-be-realized fulfillment of this prophecy in our day. And it looks that way to me. That's what's going to happen. And I really can see this being a prophecy of the next few months. Okay? Not the end of days, but of the next few months. And that's what I got through verse 9, if you'd like to comment at all, either of you.
Go ahead, Ken. If you'd like.
Yeah, it's interesting to read words such as, there's many peoples with them. The people are gathered out of the nations and they're coming for the great spoils. You know, I can't help but think of this country, and its wealth, you know, it's got so much.
Yes.
Of goods, you know, good land, good things like technology, et cetera. It's definitely a place where many would like to overcome. And that's why I was mentioning earlier, I believe that the globalists are truly working on this country more so than anywhere. I really believe they're trying to infiltrate with, you know, from our weakened borders, you know, sending in all kinds of fighting aged males. Okay. Literally millions of them are coming in that are fighting age. A lot of them are Chinese. A lot of them, of course, are, you know, Hispanics, et cetera. But I mean, we don't even know all of the types of peoples that have come in. And these could truly be the ones that come as a cloud to cover the land. It says in verse 9, you know, at some moment in time, they could show up with arms in their hands, you know, like machine guns and RPGs and, you know, who knows what, you know, just come out of the woodworks and begin trying to take land, take housing, you know, all the goods and all the, spoils, the great spoils, it says in verse 13. You're probably going to find greater spoils in this country than anywhere else in the world, I think. And truly, it seems like there's so much more going on, behind the scenes in this country than anywhere else, which is what I'm really afraid of. Not to mention, we all have a way of dwelling safely because we trust people, you know? We've lived for decades with neighbors who we trust. A lot of people even leave their doors unlocked, you know, their houses unlocked, their cars unlocked, because we feel safe. And so this kind of points us.
All right. Well, unfortunately, it points us to the top of the hour break, so we'll have to pick it up there next week. Thanks, guys. Shalom, folks.